just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayo. Here's Mike.
Hi, good morning. Welcome to the latest episode of Money Management. We are your antidote to conventional wisdom. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and we're all set to give you another hour of financial news, a recap on what's been going on in the economic world, and most importantly, how it all can affect you. Well, this past week has been pretty busy, as I'm sure you're very well aware, in terms of economic news. And from the market standpoint, 40% of all the Dow stocks and 30% of the S&P stocks gave their earnings reports this week, and there'll be a bunch more next week, and they're generally running better than expected. And the S&P 500's been pretty quiet all in all. Over the last 18 trading days, we haven't had any moves of more than 1%. That's the longest streak since November of a couple of years ago. So even though the news has been interesting, it hasn't really had a major effect on the indices. And year to date, we're at the Dow's up 6.9% about, the S&P up about 19.3%, NASDAQ's done great, it's up 36.8%, and the Russell 2000's gained 12.4%. Now, before you start digging into all your holdings and say, hey, I'm not doing as good as that. Well, the only way you would be doing as good as those is if you owned the direct asset in each index, and that's the only way. If you've got any degree of diversification, which we strongly recommend, then you would not be seeing those particular kinds of results. These are just for reference, give you an idea of what's been going on out there. So, closing yesterday, we had the Dow ending higher by 176 points at 35,459. The S&P closed up at 4582, the NASDAQ higher at 14,316. Russell 2000 ended the week up at 1981. Gold settled at $1,955 an ounce. Silver at $24.31. Crude rose to $80.06. The 10-year ended at 3.95%, and soft white wheat was quoted at $7.51 a bushel. What I'd like to do on today's program is to go over some of the announcements that were made. We'll talk about what the Fed had to say. We'll talk about the GDP. We'll talk about the PCE. For 25 cents and four box tops, I'll send you a decoder, okay? In any case, we'll be talking about some things that happened during the market and, of course, some hopefully guidance and insight about investing. And maybe even a thought about what a retired person may be wanting to consider as they move into retirement in terms of setting up their portfolios. Now, I'll start with economic-based stuff, just because it's more wide-ranging. You know, and just one thing, as we say, we like to be your antidote to conventional wisdom, and I don't know how much this affects money management, but you know all this stuff about how hot it is and everything. Well, it's hot. I mean, it's summer. That's how it goes in the summer. And there was a heat wave in the 1930s. Can you imagine that? There's like no air conditioning anywhere. Anyway, it was least on a par with the current surge in temperatures. I don't think that was due to any, if you'll pardon the term, climate change, simply because that was before 90% of the global CO2 emissions were in the atmosphere. So hard to sell that one. But it is true, some parts of the U.S. have seen a number of hotter days increase over the past 70 years, including California and New York. There are a number of large media outlets there, so too. So they look out the window and say, look it, there's weather out there. So, but most weather stations, and I'm talking about not radio, TV, but actual weather, NOAA kind of things, have shown no meaningful changes or even declines. Matter of fact, NOAA, National Oceanic Something Administration, sorry. But anyway, 81% of those folks of their weather stations reported since 1948, so that's not been real recently, there has been either a decrease or no change in the number of unusually hot days. Now, once again, heat waves happen every year, typically in the summer. But this isn't evidence that we're facing global warming. When the heat wave data are put into proper historical context as opposed to the last couple of weeks, it's clear that everything we're experiencing today, well, we've seen the movie before. So, our per capita personal emissions are lower today than at any time in the last 60 years, and lower than during World War I, when the economy was less than one-tenth as large as it is today. Again, few, if any, developed countries can claim that type of productivity achievement. So, just some facts as opposed to, noise. Now, U.S. consumer confidence rose to its highest level in 2 years in July. That, according to the Conference Board, a reflection of strong job creation and easing inflation. Home prices fell by a bit less than expected in May. That's the most recent data. As the real estate market continues to try and break its extended slump, new home sales took a bit of a breather in June. They posted a small decline, having just had 3 months of gains. But despite the negative headline number, sales are on an uptrend recently and are up 28% above the low in July a year ago. So that's a good trend. Now, the market for existing homes, that continues to struggle with its inventory problem, which is simply the difficulty of convincing current homeowners with 2 to 4% mortgages to give those low rates up and buy another house. Well, not a recipe for a significant rebound. Increasing inventory should help moderate new home prices and put a floor under sales activity. You know, one problem we have with assessing housing activity is that the Fed, as you may have noticed, held interest rates artificially low for more than a decade. Now, with rates moving more into a more normal range, sticker shock on mortgage rates for potential buyers has been real. However, we have had strong housing markets with rates at current levels and higher in the past, and home buyers will eventually adjust simply by looking at lower priced homes. Now, rates aren't actually high by historical standards, and I think that's where folks have misconstrued a lot of things. Yeah, if you've, again, if we're only talking the last 10 years, whatever's going on now sounds high. But we've seen all the headlines calling this the highest Fed funds rate in 22 years. Well, okay, well, the 10-year was 5.27 in July of 01. So that's about when this was. But in the interim years, we've had a whole lot of time, again, 10 of those years since then, in the low to no interest rate range. So, but more than anything, it shows how much the 2000s were biased toward low rates. So, you know, there's this thing called recency bias, where what happened in the most recent past, you figure is going to be normal, and that's the way it's always going to be forever and ever. No. But that's where folks have kind of hung their hats, and that's why they're having a little confusion about what these rates are all about. Now, if you take a longer view, the picture changes. Between 1982 and the end of 08, and that's just before the Fed's ZERP policy began, that's zero interest rate policy, the Fed Fed funds target rate, 5.35%. That happens to be just about the midpoint of the current range. So, obviously, these past 14 years have pulled the average lower, but still, before 08, I don't think anyone would have really batted an eye about all this stuff. You know, it's easy to get hung up on rate hikes when they are currently dominating financial headlines, along with how hot it is. Commentators globally portray Fed decisions as make or break for markets and the economy. Not unlike the debt ceiling thing and other things that the media gets their hooks into. Rate hikes are bad, they say. Rate cuts are good. Don't fight the Fed. Yet time and again, stocks generally have proven much more resilient during tightening cycles than most people expect. and the Fed. Let's shimmy over to those guys. Anyone who was hoping for a real exciting announcement from the Fed this past week, I think, was pretty disappointed. As expected, as it was well expected, the Fed funds rate increased 25 basis points to a range of 5.25 to 5.50. And 25 basis points is 0.25%. Now, what the Fed funds rate is what banks charge each other to lend overnight. And it also feeds through to many forms of consumer debt, such as mortgages, credit cards, and auto and personal loans. It has like a link effect. If that goes up, then this rate goes up, then the credit card rate goes up, and so on. With the exception of the rate hike and slight wording changes, like the modest pace of economic growth strengthened slightly to moderate. Boy, those guys really push the envelope, don't they? But the statement was a virtual carbon copy of what they said in June. But it is worth noting, too, that the Fed didn't release new economic forecasts, as the economy has pretty much moved in line with what the Fed projected in June. Now, the Fed, and this is according to Jerome Powell, the chairman, on Wednesday, he said that the Fed can afford to be a little patient as well as resolute. I think he's leaning more toward the resolute side. He goes on to say, we need to get this done. And that's a quote, referring to the anti-inflation campaign. And he goes on to say, and again I'm quoting, the record is clear that if we take too long, if we don't succeed, that pain will only be greater. And he's right there. And one more quote. I would say it's certainly possible that we will raise funds again at the September meeting if the data warrant it. And that's what his thing is. He's all hooked on data. And I would also say that it's possible that we would choose to hold steady, and we're going to be making careful assessments, as I said, meeting by meeting. He said that between now and their next meeting in September, two more employment reports, two more consumer index reports, and a report on employment costs. So everybody's going to be watching those closely for clues about what the Fed may do, whether they'll stand fast on rates next time or tick up another one. And finally, yesterday, a great bit of news, and that's what helped the market end positively. The Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index, which is what the Fed likes to use to track inflation, continued to show that it was easing. It showed that it was up 4.1% from a year ago, just below the estimate for 4.2, and that annual rate is the lowest since September of 2 years ago. So we're doing well. I want to share with you some thoughts we, use or consider when we're talking with folks about putting together a retirement income strategy. And this is not about what you should buy. No. This is just the big picture, the packaging, if you will. So, you know, what are your risks in retirement? Well, you know, spending. You spend too much, spend not enough. Healthcare, longevity, inflation, of course, and, oh, by the way, market volatility. Now, they can all present unique challenges about how your assets will be withdrawn during your retirement, and understand that your exposure to risk will help identify strategies to mitigate those risks, both now and in the future. So, what are your expenses? Now, again, I would add, just as an aside, that these comments could be applied to your portfolio regardless of where you are in your life cycle. But retirement, planning for retirement, or in retirement, when you have the fixed asset situation, for the most part, you want to consider some of these thoughts. Now, having said that, what are your current expenses? So you need to estimate your spending during retirement. In other words, if you don't know what you're spending now, you sure have hard to tell what you're going to be spending in retirement, right? So figure out. That doesn't have to be an audited CPA type piece of paper. It's just, what are we spending on? Everything. You know, you may have one-time bills during the year, insurance or taxes or what have you. But factor that in, not just the day-to-day utilities, food, car payments, gasoline, whatever. But everything that it costs you to live on right now. to include the, oh, by the way, money. Oh, by the way, I want to take a trip. Oh, by the way, I want to buy a new car. Oh, by the way, oh, happy day, I want to buy a water heater. You know, that kind of stuff. So factor all that into your planning. And you need to break down these retirement expenses into essential, discretionary, and what they call legacy. So when you do it into those three categories, it helps you identify how much money you'll need to cover that particular group and how much money is needed to have the lifestyle you want in retirement. So again, essential expenses, yeah, no hard thing here. Food, clothing, shelter, health care, taxes, right? Discretionary spending, that means you decide. So travel, club memberships, gifts, entertainment, new hot cars, things like that. But, and what some people think are discretionary, some people think are essential, kind of like health clubs or some such thing as that. And legacy expenses, what in terms of after death goals, taking care of special needs people, surviving spouses, any charities, that kind of thing. And now, what are your incomes, your stable income sources? Now, you should plan to have more than one source of income during your retirement. Many people will consider that their Social Security benefits will be the foundation of their income during retirement. But I think Social Security, for the most of us, is not often enough. You know, your stable income may ultimately include Social Security, a pension, if applicable, and perhaps some other stable distribution from rental properties or dividends. Now, will that be enough? And again, stable income that you can count on. That's the big question. If the answer is no, well, you'll have what's called an income gap. And this is where we can help you navigate your retirement income gap with some personalized, tailored solutions. You know, with this information, we can help create you a guaranteed income stream to ensure that your basic needs will always be covered. Guaranteed income includes things like Social Security, pensions, and some financial assets like annuities of different types. And the annuity guarantees are, let there be no doubt, they're not guaranteed by the feds. They're guaranteed by the financial strength and claims paying ability of the insurance company. So you'd want to be sure to know how qualitatively good your issuer is. Now, when you may have an income gap now, we can offer you guidance on creating that strategy to help you make the income, to have the income for the retirement you desire. So keep those thoughts in mind on your retirement planning tour. Okay, let's move over to what we like to call investing. And, including, now this goes back to good solid data going back to 1926, 1928, around in there, so we can make some sort of, this is the way it was then and here it is now. So going back to 28, stock market returns, including dividends, are 70% higher than just stock price returns alone. Whoa. So what does that tell you? Dividends are a major reason why you hold stocks long term. And so that total return, that's growth plus your dividend, is around 35 times higher than price return alone. So don't, I just want growth. Well, good for you. But it's okay to have growth in income, And by the way, I have written an article for the Spokane Journal of Business. I think I called it something like retirement investing or something catchy like that. But it's going to be in the next one or two issues, so you might want to keep your eye open for that. And you'll see not too much emphasis on bonds and things, but I hope you find it interesting. So when it comes to fund managers today, I'm talking about now, cash is still their largest position. And they are the most bearish on stocks. Now, fund managers, these are folks that run big money. Mutual funds, family offices, corporate accounts, serious money. But they're still mostly bearish on stocks. Now, J.P. Morgan did a survey recently that asked if they plan, these kinds of people, if they plan to increase or decrease their exposure to stocks in the near term. Only 17% said they're likely to add to the stock exposure. And it's when they all plan to add to stocks that you might want to start looking for your lifeboat, because we're probably close to a near-term top at that time. But currently, it's the exact opposite. These guys are all scared to death. I don't know what planet they live on, because the S&P 500, the Dow, the Nasdaq have all been closing at new 52-week highs. You know, here's a newsflash for those cats. This is not something you see in downtrends. So what do we know? Well, stocks have been going up consistently over the past year, and most investors are not participating because they're being influenced by these people. Who are they listening to? I mean, these fund managers and their like. You know, remember that after the greatest first half of the Nasdaq ever, most of these Wall Street kids are still maintaining their most bearish second half outlook on record. So best first half in history in Nasdaq, worst projection for the second half. There's something's got to give here. And, you know, I think investors have been, they found themselves following these investment Pied Pipers into some really bad decisions. There's plenty of cash and dry powder on the sidelines. American Express said, excuse me, spending through its credit cards reached an all-time high. Families continue to spend on travel, vacation, and entertainment. So the bull market continues. I want to talk to you now about some things that we in what we do for a living take for granted, and I think most folks out there are not that really aware of what it all means. And I'm talking about the indices, you know, the S&P, the Nasdaq, the Dow. I just want to give you a little quick overview as to what each of them means, because while they each track the markets, for sure, but they don't do it exactly in the same way. See, over the last 15 years, both the S&P and Dow have moved in the same direction 94% of the time. That's according to CNBC. Now, over that same period, the S&P and NASDAQ were up in the same direction about 92% of the time. So, you know, if one's up, the other one's up pretty much. So the S&P, that's the one that has become the forefront. Because now, when investing pros talk about market returns, they're usually talking about this one. And that's because the index tracks, now I know this required a lot of deep thinking, but about 500 of the largest U.S. traded stocks. So that's about 80% of all the stocks traded on the market. This index came to be in 1957. It was the first one that was what they call weighted by market capitalization. Market capitalization, or shorthand market cap, is where you take your stock price times the numbers of shares outstanding. So the higher the price and the more shares outstanding, the higher the capitalization. Okay. So admission into the S&P is generally based on a company's size and other mathematical variables. But today it's the favored benchmark for fund managers and other professional managers who measure themselves against the broad market. Now, thanks to its weighting criteria, again, the S&P tilts toward the biggest companies. So now it currently leads toward tech, which makes up just about 30% of the index in today's market. Now, the Dow is very much the, linchpin from which all of this started. It debuted in 1896, and it was railroad stocks and, I forget a couple other companies, but railroad stocks were like the internet stocks of the 1890s. But, you know, it still carries some of the conventions that existed before computers made stocks easy to track. That's why one reason why there's only 30 stocks, and that's all, they're chosen by a committee. So rather than weighing the stocks by market cap, the top spots go to the stocks that have the highest share price. So that means that certain high price names can't be added as they'd have too big an effect on the index performance. And so because of its focus on high-quality, dividend-paying firms, the a.k.a. blue chips, the Dow's tended to hold up better than some of the other indices in the down markets. Now, the key reason strong economic data, along with weakening inflation, can help the Dow more so than the other indices is because of its makeup. Many of the stocks in the Dow are basically directly levered to an improving economy. How about American Express, Chevron, Coke, 3M? Yeah, so it's all kind of oriented that way. And finally, the Nasdaq. The Nasdaq is the high flyer currently. It includes all the stocks listed on the Nasdaq stock market, which is the first electronic stock exchange. Now, more than 2,500 stocks are in the index, and they lean heavily toward the tech and communications sectors. And like the S&P, Nasdaq's weighted by market cap, which means that the fast-growing tech giants tend to dominate. Apple and Microsoft together make up a quarter of the index. So you can see then why this past year that the Nasdaq has posted such eye-popping returns. And of course, that means reverse is true too, doesn't it? And so when people are bailing from the techs, for example, back in 2001-02, when the tech bubble, or the dot-com bubble more correctly, popped, the Nasdaq was off a mere 78%. Compared with 49% in the S&P and 34% in the Dow. A dubious distinction for sure. So, now that you're all educated on that, let's talk about this recession stuff. What the heck? You talk about crying wolf, my goodness. You know, forecasters have been predicting a recession was right around the corner since the Fed started lifting interest rates more than a year ago. But they repeatedly postponed the start date. In one respect, a downturn in the next 6 months would be pretty unusual because it would mean that the current expansion that we're in will have lasted just 4 years. Now, I say that because the last four expansions we've had have averaged 8.6 years. So that simply suggests that the end of this particular one could be years away. And again, that I wouldn't take that to the bank necessarily, but it does suggest that, again, one less reason to be looking over your shoulder. Now, one reason U.S. consumers are still spending, how about a solid labor market? I mean, my goodness, worker filings for unemployment declined 7,000 last week to an adjusted 221,000. That's from the Labor Department. And that is the lowest level since February, close to 2019's average of about 220,000 folks being unemployed. So if you want a good explanation as to why we haven't gone into recession, I think it's probably some combination of the excess savings from all the pandemic handouts, pent-up demand from not spending in 2020. The current consumer balance sheets are in pretty good shape. And let us not forget that we do love spending money in this country. Now, I can't make any promises about how long all this nice good stuff's going to last because, like everything, the economy is cyclical. And it's now the positive turn in the barrel, it would assume. But for now, it's nice we didn't have to go through a recession or haven't had to go through a recession and see a whole lot of folks lose their jobs just to bring inflation back to more reasonable levels. Now, I think, and I'm not the Lone Ranger here, I don't believe, but the Fed had little choice but to raise the interest rates and risk a recession in order to control inflation before it became just more a part of the economy. And the economy seems to have shrugged off their rate increases so far. Stocks, home prices, employment's holding up, no sign of a near-term recession. You know, higher rates typically have controlled inflation by discouraging spending, hiring, investing, which of course then leads to higher unemployment, which then leads to lower demand and puts more pressure on prices. But this inflation has cooled, it's not gone, but it's cooled without joblessness spiking, and so other factors must be at work. business closures, lockdowns, travel restrictions, a couple of years ago, that shifted demand to goods from services. And that goofed up global supply chains massively and sent everything from shipping costs to used car prices skyward. I mean, you saw that movie. You know how it is. And more importantly, the work-from-home boom ignited a demand for houses, which kind of put us in the situation we are now in the real estate market, because it had the knock-on effect of lifting rental costs and boosting the shares of the nation's largest home builders to highs as people focused on new home purchases, because that's pretty much all that's available out there, generally speaking. Now, all these forces kind of came together more than a year ago, but have only been reflected in recent months due to lags in inflation measures. So there's this outfit called the National Bureau of Economic Research, NBER, and they've been officially calling for U.S. downturns since either GDP or gross national product were reported. And so they look at an array of measures, but those measures, the most important part of which is job growth. So far it indicates the economy is expanding. And just to reiterate, the Commerce Department reported Thursday that the GDP, the sum of all goods and services activity in the country, increased at 2.4%. That's from April through June, which was much better than the 2% consensus estimate, and which was how much it grew in the first quarter. The economists were only looking for 1.5% growth up to 2.2% growth. So obviously their crystal balls were somewhat cloudy. And so inflation was kept in check. Personal consumption expenditures index increased to 2.6%, down from 4.1%. Again, the trend is our friend here. You know, I was saying at the end of the last segment that the job market is really what's having a lot to do with keeping recession away from the door. And non-farm payrolls, this came out, I think, Thursday. Non-farm payrolls grew by nearly 1.7 million so far this year. And the 3.6 unemployment rate is the same as it was a year ago. Now, consumers, meanwhile, again, continue to spend. Sentiment gauges have been rising in recent months. The University of Michigan sentiment survey hit nearly a two-year high in July. So consumer spending has cooled a bit, but it's risen enough to drive overall growth alongside a much stronger business investment in the second quarter. And incomes rose in June, up 5.3% over the last year, led by gains in private sector wages and salaries. All good news. Okay, the outlook. So this is just some thoughts, my own as well as some other folks, about where we're going from here. And again, obviously, I won't say obviously, but generally speaking, my tendencies are to the positive side, because that's how the markets work out. Historically speaking, 70% of the time, the markets are up. I say that's a pretty solid bet. So, where are we? You know, fear. That's a tough thing, because it's different for everybody. What causes some people to be afraid, other people go, what? And other people, spiders, mice, things like that. But we're talking about bigger stuff, like, your assets dropping in value, things like that. That may get a lot more people's attention. You know, fear, it isn't forced on you. It's something you put on yourself. Well, I talk about these pundits, and I use the term in quotes, as chicken littles. You know, the chicken that got hit in the head with an acorn, and therefore the sky is falling, the world is ending. And so you get a variation on a theme like that from a lot of these market readers. And, most people today, investors in particular, seem to follow a lot of these chicken little pundits and are treating each and every negative headline, call it an acorn, as a surefire indicator that the economy and or markets are bound to crash. Because they never say they're bound to go up, even though the record is there. So just think about the last 10 years alone. You know, all of all the so-called perilous threats to financial and or geopolitical stability that have been run out for us, yep, here we still are. Unemployment close to all-time lows and the stock market near record highs. That's why I always say, you know, when these guys start talking, just put your fingers in your ears. Now, J.P. Morgan analysts ran the numbers. They found there is no linear relationship between valuations and one-year returns. Now, what that means is, if something's worth a lot today, doesn't necessarily increase the likelihood that next year's returns will be weak. Conversely, a cheap valuation doesn't necessarily increase the likelihood that next year's returns will be strong. Steve Eisman, he's senior portfolio manager at Neuberger Berman, and I'm quoting, he said, so far there's no evidence of a recession. So long as there's no evidence of recession, I think the market will probably continue to melt up. People are chasing. It's the FOMO thing, fear of missing out. You know, and you know, markets move on expected events coming over the next 3 to 30 months. And that's any time. I mean, not just today. And so 2024 would be within that range. It would be within 3 and 30 months of last year's bear market. And, of course, the vast majority of economists jumped on the recession wagon, and I think a lot of them are still riding that thing. So we think it's fair to say that stocks have priced in those projections pretty much during the downturn, and that's normal. So, you know, it's talk of that is pretty much non-eventful in terms of moving the markets. Stocks are also well aware that the projections have been revised rather than erased. So that says that that must be priced in already to deliver a new negative shock, which would be capable of sending stocks down significantly. Any recession would have to be much worse than the forecast the markets have already allowed for. This is possible. Everything's possible, but not probable. You know, in investing, it's probabilities that matter, not just possibilities. You know, Morgan Housel, he writes The Psychology of Money, he said, good investing isn't necessarily about earning the highest returns, because the highest returns tend to be one-off hits that can't be repeated. And that is a true thing. It's about earning pretty good returns that you can stick with and which can be repeated over the longest period of time. You know, think of it as like hitting singles and doubles as opposed to always trying to hit for the fence, right? Your averages are going to probably look a lot better. Now, we've also got Monmouth College released a survey last week, a lot of charts and data, but it was there was one graph that stood out. It said, some indicators suggest the U.S. economy has been recovering better than other countries from the worldwide instability and rising prices brought on by COVID. However, and we're back to the misunderstanding of the economy, just 30% of the American public believes that. In fact, 32% say the U.S. economy's recovery from this situation is worse than other countries, and another third say the U.S. recovery is about the same as the rest of the world. You know, it's kind of interesting to me that people with little or no knowledge or experience about the economic strength of foreign countries have absolutely no hesitation in making definitive opinions on that very subject, or inflation, or the economy, or what have you. Now, what about inflation, which peaked a year ago and is now down to about 3% on a year-over-year basis? Well, the survey from Monmouth College says 60% of respondents believe inflation is continuing to increase. Now, last time I talked, you know, when you do the math, from 9 to 3 is a decrease. But apparently, wherever these people went to school didn't either have subtraction or they didn't do well in that segment. I'm not sure. But this is where emotions cloud logic. That's really what's going on. Now, people don't really have much luck forecasting the future. They're easily persuaded by members of what they call their own tribes. In other words, folks who share their same world views or economic views or what have you. And they are less than accurate when it comes to understanding their own thinking. Ask a simple question about the state of the economy or how they're doing, and the results are almost a whole bunch of contradictions. So keep an eye on monetary policy, but don't be fooled into obsessing about it. Small rate wiggles, you know, like the Fed does, generally don't move the needle, good or bad, and because monetary policy hits the economy with a long lag, there's plenty of time to assess conditions and make whatever adjustments you need as possible. So, that is it for this week. I thank you very much for listening. I hope you found it helpful and informative. We'll be back next week, and hopefully we'll still see the markets doing what they're doing. You've been listening to Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. My name is Mike Mayo, and again, I thank you very much for listening.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Opus 111's Mike Mayo. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.